Green politics. Too little, too late in our deeply troubled world? Should green parties have remained an activist force rather than engage in party politics at all? Well, no one has a better overview of such questions than lawyer Harry Vassallo. He's chaired Malta's Green Party between 1998 and 2008. As well as that, he's been a law reporter for the Times of Malta, specialising in human rights violations. In 2015, he headed Malta's legal unit overseeing the country's presidency of the Council of the European Union. And he's also been engaged in European animal health and welfare issues, matters of strong green concern. So welcome to the Political Compass podcasts, Harry Vassallo.
Hi.
Harry, I should also mention your prominent role in the European Federation of Green Parties. That was in the earlier days when, I guess, Green Parties proliferated after Petra Kelly in the early 80s in Germany got the whole thing started.
Yes, when we formed our third party in Malta, we wanted it to be my bit of history that I presented our case to the Greens, and that's how we joined. We became an authentic Green Party by being recognized at that point.
So one of the early ones?
Yes, I would say so. Well, we would, certainly not the first.
One of the criticisms of Green parties in the early days is that they had no social base and they were sort of a one-trick pony and the environment didn't really give them a binding ideology in the way that the other parties enjoy that identity. And I do remember hearing that in Petra Kelly's day, there was some alarm among progressive people who had started the Green parties because some old Nazis found it attractive as well. They had this kind of reactionary view of the forest connected with nationalism and the healthy mind and the healthy body and, you know, Lederhosen and the mountains and all that sort of thing, which wasn't at all what Petra Kelly had in mind.
Definitely. But that is principally a German concern, for it never crossed anybody's mind in any other Green Party from Georgia to Ireland. But for the Germans, yes, it was a real concern.
So would you say that Greens today have a defined social base in the same way that the other parties have traditionally had?
Well, yes, in the sense that I think it is fundamental for the Greens to think globally. So if you're talking of a social base, social concern, they take it beyond the nation. So they don't think that we can solve our problems if we don't solve the injustice between the north and the south in the world. And within their own nation, certainly we are tagged as socialists in many countries. And we do tend to ally ourselves more easily with the left, but we are not bound to them in any way, in the sense that when we want to get things done, we have formed all sorts of coalitions in municipalities and even in national parliaments.
Well,
there are limits.
I'm aware of the problem that Green parties must have on this word growth, because the left and the right equally promise growth. It's accepted that all political parties will naturally be attached to the idea of growth, and yet growth is the very thing that Green parties must be guarded against, because climatologists tell us that we can't afford to have growth. So how do Greens get around this contradiction without being dishonest?
Well, I think for most Greens, it's not a particular problem. It's very clear that we live on a very finite planet. And I remember a poster with this big blue marble of the Earth seen from space, and somebody's handing it over as a penny and said, don't spend it all at once. And it is what inspires a lot of people to join any ecologist party, that we are wasting resources, not closing the circle. So ecology and economy are basically the same thing, because the resources we have, which we have to use. And Greens promote the idea of closing the circle in use, to follow nature in reusing things and creating circles of use rather than one-way consumption. So growth in this consumer way where you dig things up and burn them out is certainly not the green model, and the Greens can't promote that in any way. However, you can talk of economic growth in the sense of added value. A lot of things which are junk thrown away can be reused and be given value. We can create many new jobs and opportunities of employment, and there have been many, many tens of thousands created in the green economy. And that will continue to grow because it's inevitable.
But nevertheless, the economic orthodoxy that we're living in under globalization is in complete conflict with the ecological necessity, isn't it?
Well, I think it's pretty clear to anybody who stops to think for a while. So I really don't think I want to harp on that very much. It's pretty obvious.
We're living in an age, though, where economic power has transcended political power. So sometimes I wonder if you could even elect Che Guevara and he wouldn't be able to make a whole lot of difference because he'd no longer control the purse strings.
Yes, I often think that Reaganomics and Thatcherism are a bit like the Titanic. The momentum is still there. It has won over the world, basically. The idea of greed is good carries on to this day. And this idea of making as much money as you can is your life's aim has seduced millions and millions of people, and not only the rich 1%. Yes, to turn this Titanic around is a huge challenge.
Maybe the Titanic is not the best analogy because we won't have any icebergs left for it to crash into.
Well, we'll find one, don't worry. A metaphorical one, maybe, but we have to turn this around. And if we don't, we're looking at a very grim time ahead.
Looking back over your earlier times with the Green Movement and your involvement in the overview you had in the EU period, do you think it was a mistake for Green parties to actually get engaged in the parliamentary process? Would it not have been better to have remained an activist force that could make appeals to everybody without threatening their existing allegiances?
Well, let me talk about myself, and maybe you can extrapolate from that. I had no intention to ever go into politics, but unfortunately we had a situation between the left and the right here, which was nearly a civil war, human rights violations and political violence and corruption. And in the midst of that, what persuaded me was our problem was having two sides, basically two parties in our case. And I think everybody who formed our Green Party had recognized that we need a third way and rejected violence. So there isn't a lot of choice left. The other parties are not going to listen to anything except a threat in Parliament. Our first electoral result was 1.8%, and it was horribly disappointing to us, but we realized that it was incredibly frightening to the other two parties because we could upset the apple cart for them. And we have not made it into Parliament, despite all our struggles since 1989. And yet, most of our proposals at every election are adopted by the other parties. So the idea of contesting elections, having a program, making proposals, changes the world, even though we are not in Parliament. So I think this applies to all other Green parties. Our argument is convincing, but we cannot convince the public. Well, with our electoral system, there are other issues, but to convince, except in places like Germany, where circumstances are quite particular, it's quite difficult to convince a mass of people that Greens are government-worthy. They can't imagine us as ministers or prime minister and so on. It has happened, but it's a rare occurrence.
And the Green vote seems to plateau much more and be much more stable than that of the other parties, suggesting that there's a certain element of Green people in society and not a lot of wavering going on.
Yes, it's true for us here. And there's a core vote that sticks with the Greens. How to expand it and it is quite a challenge because for you to go for the mass vote, you're going to have to water down your message. And it's a problem with all politicians, I suppose, with Greens in particular, that if you sup with the devil, basically, and say, yes, we'll tell a few lies or not tell the truth, and get the votes, and then we'll be honest afterwards or get our thing done. It doesn't work like that. Once you start watering down your message, it's gone. So I think we have to keep harping at it. The other thing is you have to look at electoral systems and the way they work and the way they're operated. It's very hard to break in. So you have the British system, which they've been first past the post, and they haven't had an actual majority government since, I think, 1930-something. Well, it's not very democratic from my point of view. But for most parties, a lot of the issue is public financing of political parties. You mentioned Germany. After a certain level, every party has public finance, which gave the Greens a big boost, made it possible for them to grow. For a lot of Green parties, where are they going to get their money from? Certainly not membership subscriptions, which are a few. And if they follow the other parties, what are they going to get it from? The corporate world, the construction business? It doesn't make sense. So growing is a huge challenge.
Yeah, and growth is the one thing that promises success on the political arena. If you promise great drive for growth, then you have more chance of political success, right? Growth is definitely not a pejorative, even though climatologists tell us that it is. We always look for success in terms of quantity rather than quality, right?
If you're talking economics, I think you certainly can't tell people we're all going to be poor and eating nothing or having drastic changes to our lifestyle and expect them to support you. So you have to propose something else. And the possibility of having a decent life, a decent working economy, good levels of employment from a green economy is something to propose.
And yet, given the enormity of the existential issues that we're facing, most of the measures that are coming out of the parliamentary process are homeopathic, to say the least, aren't they?
Well, I would say that it depends where and what we are talking about. Many green ideas about sustainability and pushing the green economy have become mainstream within the EU. So they are no longer particularly green ideas because they've been endorsed by all the political families there. And huge investment has been done. I mean, we're at the dream level on certain things compared to when we started. But yes, if you look at the particular economies, you have a lot of, let's call them traditional politicians, who pay lip service to green ideas because they can see them growing, they can see that they're popular, and they do something that looks green. It's the same in the commercial world. Everybody wants to have a product which is ecological, sustainable, biological, whatever. It's a catchphrase. It's very annoying to Greens because it seems to be turning the whole message banal.
In the age of career politicians, where more and more politicians are actually, for their own pragmatic purposes, changing their party allegiances and walking across the house, in Denmark, almost every week, a politician walks across the floor to join another party. Green parties seem to be more aligned with the idea that you have a conviction, so you go into politics rather than become a career politician. You start from the position of this has to change, so I'll become a politician, rather than I'll become a politician, now what shall I believe in?
Yes, we certainly start like that. When time goes by and you've been supping with the devil for a long time, we are not all saints and there are failures. And people have made mistakes or have changed their minds because they have every right to. But yes, generally speaking, I think the mass of people start as green and stay as green. Our Prime Minister once asked me what was the future of the Green Party after the last failure in an election. And I told him that after every election, people invite themselves to our funeral. And he had a good laugh on that one. And I said, we will be defeated when our ideas are defeated. So the people who start loving that idea or convinced about that idea will not give it up until it becomes real.
Of course, when you want change and as radical change as the pure green movement wants, inevitably you're going to get much more diversity of opinion and conflict of ideology than in a comfortable conservative party where everyone's united by what they don't want. And so you must have been aware of very agonizing debates going on within Green parties between absolute purists and the pragmatic wing.
Yes, the further away you are from actual power, the more theoretical debate there is and the more heated it is. This is in my experience across European Green parties. You can afford to be theoretical when basically you're not going to be asked to do something about it that will change people's lives. And you can get very hot under the collar about ideas. But once you're in power and you have to take decisions in the real world, the theoretical debate must meet reality. And that we have seen with the Greens, in Germany in particular. The other extreme would be the Maltese or the English Greens, where you have only one member of parliament and the rest is a glorified debating society.
I'm sure you'd find a lot of people in Britain who would be nodding in agreement with that idea. So given the times that we're living in and the threats that we're facing, how much of a doomsday scenario are Greens prepared to present to the public? Because their message has to have become more urgent than it was 10, 15 years ago.
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty about the future, even among the scientists. They can't provide us with all the answers. But I would think that we should be talking in a business way. I'm thinking of Onassis, and the rules of thumb that I learned from him was borrow big and pay back quickly. And the other thing, don't risk more than you can afford to lose. And I think that the world should be made aware of what we are about to lose if we don't do something about it. So it's pretty grim, as I said earlier, and I think very much of my own children about the world they are going to face that I didn't have to face. We live at a time with all the horror and stupidity of the world that we see on our TV every day, at the best era of human development, and we can't keep it up because we're about to lose it because we don't want to take care of it. We don't want to take the few actions that we really need to do to get things going in the right direction. Not fast enough, certainly.
A wise man once said that human beings will do anything to get out of a bad situation except change.
I'll tell you another one. I think that the success of humanity has been our adaptability and our ability to accommodate the situation, whatever it is. Think of the Inuit north of the Arctic Circle and the people who live in deserts. We're fantastic. I mean, the only creature that I think that can compete with us are cockroaches, probably. The thing is, when a disaster is looming, we tend to believe that we will be able to adapt. And then there's another thing that when things are too horrible, we go into denial. And I think that is the state we're in now.
Right. I mean, your more optimistic note in the first part of that would be a hard sell to the people in the Amazonian rainforest who have been displaced.
Yes. Will they be able to adapt to the new world? I don't know. Possibly, yes. It may be horrible, but they will. We do adapt. And unfortunately, we do go with the flow in that sense. Instead of saying we want to keep things as they are, we want to make the effort to keep the natural cycle going because there's no waste in that, because we can live off it carefully. No, we end up taking a job in a city because the fields the forests are destroyed and we're growing hamburgers. So
where does that leave us for the future? Because we are actually moving into a world now that is going more into the deregulation of industry, of big business. There's more deregulation than regulation at a time when regulatory steps are more urgent than ever before.
Well, I think reality bites. If we head too far in that direction, I think we're going to have... I think we already have more than an announcement of climate change in the weather of the last few years. In the next few years, we can't see anything better. And we're going to be told, you can't mess around anymore.
But we've been told that for years, Harry. We've been told for years you can't mess around. And people continue to mess around and they keep hearing they can't mess around.
But I think the level of extreme weather is far more than it has been in the last several years. And the cost is enormous. So that will start to wake people up in the money world. There are some things which are completely unsustainable economically. It will change. We are seeing countries change, not only in things like desertification, a slow process which is going away far from the media, but you have more violent and more frequent hurricanes in the United States, typhoons in Japan and in China, Indonesia and the Philippines. How many times can people repair their infrastructure, repair their homes for them to be destroyed within a week? They are going to wake up to this and try to find the causes. I mean, if we go at this exponential rate of climb over the next few years, I don't think we're talking about 2050 or 100 years. I think before we have the spectacular disasters that or nightmare scenarios of climate change, the economic impact of smaller changes is more than we can bear. You don't need to have the Gulf Stream stop and we have a new ice age in the Northern Hemisphere for people to wake up. It will wake up long before, through extreme weather in particular.
But the extreme weather in many countries and on mainstream weather forecasts on television programs is still treating these strange new developments in weather as one-off aberrations. They're not really recognizing it as part of a changed situation. And, you know, the public say, what a disappointing summer we had, or what a hot winter we had. And it's not really talked about in global terms.
You will remember the fire at Notre Dame, which touched people around the world, not only French people or Parisians, but everybody who knew the place in one way or another. And a huge amount has been invested in its restoration. Now, try to imagine the Gothic cathedrals and various other monuments in Europe being struck by violent weather year after year. In the end, it will not be possible to repair them. It will not be economically thinkable that you will restore these things. And the damage from constant and growing climate change will be there for everybody to see. When somebody's roof is blown away, oh, that is a terrible disaster. It's the weather. Hopefully it will never happen again. But when it is monuments and things that have stood for 500 years and more being blown down, people will start to wake up to the idea that this is not the weather. It is not an odd event. This is a major change, an epochal change, and we've got to do something about it.
But when it gets to that extreme state, surely it's too late.
I hope it won't be. This is a green thing. From our experience in many fields, it takes a disaster for people to wake up. I'm thinking of the Seveso Directive in the EU, where in Seveso there was a factory that blew up and covered the town in dioxin, poisoning children and what have you. Now we have a rule on toxic contents in factories that have to be controlled, declared, and so on. Without that disaster, without the deaths, without the cancers in Seveso, we wouldn't have the directive. Unfortunately, we only learn from disasters. So if you're a green, you may not declare it in politics, and I'm not active in politics anymore, so I feel a little freer. You wish that we have a small disaster for people to wake up in time, because the big one will mean that it's too late.
Well, we had more than a small disaster in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It didn't lead to the outlawing of nuclear weapons. It led to the arms race.
Yes. It depends. You know, that's another case. What interests you have, you see? And yes, I think there's a danger in this case too, because certainly there was great interest in promoting nuclear weapons or nuclear technology, even dressing it up as free energy to be able to justify the whole technology. In the case of climate change and so on, we have the energy companies knew about climate change many decades ago, and instead of changing course, preparing for a change, they have actually invested in misinformation in a very, very big way. So who's on the other side? Who's going to be working to delay this whole business? That is a major concern, yes.
Well, Milton Friedman famously said that the only social responsibility of a company was to deliver a profit to its shareholders.
I think he's right. I'm a lawyer. If you look at the statute of any company, that is the point, the bottom line. Maybe we should change it. Now we talk about corporate social responsibility, but I think that is a lot of cosmetics. We've got to institutionalize legally, not in a voluntary manner, corporate social responsibility. We've also got to do things like create criminal responsibility. So we talked about misinformation of oil companies. Yes, they're causing the deaths of thousands by exposing them to climate change. Will they ever pay? In many, many other ways, we have had corporations get away with it, where responsibility doesn't come home. And I'm not talking of paying damages. If you have committed what would be a crime if committed by a natural person, the decision to commit that crime was taken by a human being, and it must come all the way home. And when we have laws in this sense, we will have people thinking twice about taking such crooked decisions.
It's just that, you know, I keep coming back to this thing of regulation. We are in a deregulatory mindset in our globalized world. Deregulation is the order of the day. We have growing success among the libertarian parties and even the extremities of Ayn Rand's ideas. And this is at a time when, as you're saying, we need more regulation, not less. We're moving surely in the opposite direction.
It looks like it, and there will be a cost for it. But now, in my 69th year, I've seen the pendulum swing in various things. So maybe I have more hope than younger people that the pendulum will reach the end of its arch and start coming back the other way.
But Harry, doesn't hope always come from a position of disempowerment?
Oh, yes. Who has the power in this world? Certainly not me. Not billions of people either. So if you can't even hope, what do you do? But there is the other side of things. I told you when we entered politics, we had the experience of political violence and rejected it. And I still do. But if the world keeps going in this way, where people have no power and the decisions are going the wrong way, we will see more political violence and we will have what is labeled as green fascism. We will have people being able to pin down the responsibility for natural disasters on particular people. And, it will come to that in the end, because it will be the issue.
Well, along with population and a lot of other existential problems, I'm thinking peak oil, food and water security, nuclear threat, and so on. But in the case of population, the world was worried about zero population growth being achieved in the late 1960s, I believe. On our podcast, we have interviewed Paul Ehrlich about that one. And yet, we are more than double the population of the late 1960s, and people aren't talking about population. Is it even responsible in the uncertain world we're living in to have children at this time?
It feels very much like it. But I don't think that there is sufficient awareness around the world about what the future holds. So people are carrying on business as usual in many parts of the world, not in all of them. I think that concern about the future among young people today and their willingness to produce children is apart from the economic difficulty of forming and holding a family, is a concern, and you have population growth in some places of the world, but certainly not in the developed world. We're talking of the graying of America, the graying of Europe, and yes, clearly. So without any draconian measures taken as the Chinese took and India took, Europe has reduced its population growth except through immigration. So it is a concern about population, but I think, unfortunately, it's for the people who are better off. It's a luxury item, and it's a question of there are many elements to it, empowerment of women and so on.
And that brings us right back, doesn't it, to Petra Kelly, because the thing that she did was to connect a lot of dots. She linked racism with peace and nuclear issues, ecology, feminism. Are we dot connecting in the same way today?
Listen, there's nothing which is not connected, and it's not a sort of mind game of mental associations. Yes, everything is connected. It's become a bit of a trash word to say holistic. But yes, you have to have a view that isn't pigeonholed and allow for the effects of things which seem unrelated at first, but certainly are not. In fact, one of the big challenges in all green issues is that they are complicated. They are not sound bites. They are not 2 + 2 = 4. You would think of toxicity in products or emissions or so on, causing damages 20, 30 years later in people's health. So, yes, everything is connected, and the trend should be, because you were talking about deregulation, is to internalize what are considered externalities in business. And there is a trend to do that, to count in factors which in traditional economics were considered as too small to consider, that they could be ignored, that they had to be ignored because otherwise the calculations get too complicated. And now there is a trend to include them. And that this will continue. This will has to continue.
And yet I'm looking at young people and I'm looking at the increasingly corporatized university and how business studies have really eclipsed the humanities. You have a situation now where people are studying event management, they're studying human resources, so-called, and many other things which have absolutely no relevance to the kind of world we're moving into.
Well, I don't expect everybody to become an ecologist.
No, no, but you wouldn't expect so many people to be studying business at a time when there are other more vital things to be engaged with.
I made my choices, and I am very wary about thinking that everybody should have done the same thing with the same passion that I had. And it takes all sorts to make a world. I don't know the statistics, but I see a lot of improvement and professionalism and interest from science in matters which were completely disregarded when I started out. So it's not a question of hope. It's a question of experience and seeing people making careers in things which we dealt with as complete amateurs. I am hopeful in that sense. There's a lot more science in ecology and in a broad way than there was 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, except that science faculties, science academics continually tell me that more and more of the science faculty has been funded by business rather than the state, and they're dedicated to doing things that have no social purpose for the wider population.
Yeah, that is a concern, not only from an ecological point of view, but across the board. If we expect business to finance universities and not be self-interested, I think it's unrealistic. And I think the state has been absent in many ways, in the sense that before I mentioned Reaganism and Thatcherism. When you think of how much the state funding there is in research and what the give back from it is, I see that it's completely disproportionate. I'm thinking of pharmaceuticals, for instance. A lot of the research is public funded, and then it is privately exploited, if you want to call it that. The public element is not, how shall I put it, defended by the public, defended by governments. The investment is open-handed, and we don't demand enough back. So I think with education and funding of universities, leaving it to the corporations or not having an influence to rebalance the thing is dangerous. But I think it's across the board.
Are governments actually acting in the interests of their citizens as intensively as they did decades ago? Or are they actually more answerable to their corporate paymasters?
I think they're answerable to their greed, I think, more than anything else. It's pretty obvious. We have cases of corruption, shocking cases of corruption everywhere. some places more spectacular and stupid than in others. But we have the examples of people who are men and women of honor and people who sacrifice themselves for their countrymen in politics are few and far between. I can think of a few. I won't mention them because there'll be some controversy there. But they are a tiny minority. And I don't think that everybody in politics is a rotten thief, but they certainly give that impression. And the general public has lost faith in politics because of continuous scandals. So, yes, I think we have a serious problem there. We have, and it is a civilization issue. If the leaders don't believe in the system, will the people believe in the system? And I don't think anybody does anymore, at least not the younger generations have been cured of their belief.
I mentioned before the growing absence of conviction politicians, and I realize that there are more convicted politicians now.
That may mean that the system is working. I don't know.
We'll have to leave it there, Harry. Thank you very much for your time. And I'm wondering what sort of line our conversation might take if we do the same thing again in 5 years' time.
I hope we'll have the opportunity to do it.
Okay. And thank you again for being on the Political Compass podcast.
You're welcome.